Good evening. I'm Spencer Graves, your host for this episode of Radioactive Magazine. Tonight's show will cover three distinct topics: economics, the Kansas Open Meetings Act, and elections to be held this new year, 2017, in Kansas and Missouri. First, you will hear comments from Stephanie Kelton, recorded on December 29. She's a professor of economics at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. She served as chief economist for the Democrats on the Senate Budget Committee in 2015 and then as an economic advisor to the Sanders campaign in 2016. Kelton has been a leading contributor to the development of modern monetary theory. She says the fiscal and monetary policy in the U.S. has focused too much on inflation, and the U.S. could have faster, more broadly shared economic growth by managing the economy for full employment. Inflation has not been a problem in the United States since the 1970s, and that was a product of oil shocks. For a very long time now, the primary limit to economic growth in the U.S. has been insufficiency of demand because the poor and middle class have not had enough money to buy the goods and services that the economy could produce. Graves met Kelton in September 2016 at the 13th International Post-Keynesian Conference hosted by her department at UMKC. Kelton's specialty, modern monetary theory, is a branch of post-Keynesian economics.
My message as an economist is that we have and have had an economy that has been performing well below its potential, that we could have a much more prosperous economy, have millions more people employed full-time. We could have higher growth rates. We could have more prosperity, higher economic well-being, however different ways we want to measure that, if we had better macroeconomic policies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basic message.
Right. Now, and what are the components of those better macroeconomic policies?
Well, so basically you have two options. One is to work through fiscal policy, and the other is to work through monetary policy. Monetary policy means relying mostly on the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve used to, in the old days, the Fed, that policy was pretty straightforward. They just changed the overnight interest rate. So the Fed would cut interest rates when it was trying to encourage borrowing and spending in order to try to stimulate the economy, boost jobs, and so forth. And they would raise interest rates when they got worried about inflation. And they would try to discourage borrowing and spending, and try to slow the economy down.
Mm-hmm.
And the other policy arm is, of course, fiscal policy, which is run through the Congress. And that means broadly changing government spending and changing taxes.
Right.
So if you're trying to encourage job creation, you know, businesses hire when they're swamped with customers. So how do you bring lots and lots of customers to the register, to the storefront? You make sure that there are consumers with lots of money to spend.
Yeah.
You want to go out and be consumers, right? So how can government try to boost job creation by boosting consumer spending, let's say? Well, tax cuts are one way to do it. So you cut taxes and people end up with higher disposable income.
But that depends on who you cut. That's talking
you
about
bet it
taxes.
Does.
What?
You bet it does. Yes. So if you cut taxes and the benefits are largely skewed toward those who are already at the very high end of the income distribution, then you're not going to encourage a lot of additional spending because those people already have all the income they need to buy all the things that they want to buy. And reducing income tax rates, marginal income tax rates for those at the very top, doesn't add much additional spending. But if you cut taxes for those at the bottom who are already spending everything they make and probably more, they're going to spend basically every additional dollar they get to keep. So you're going to get much more of a macro stimulus from tax cuts that are designed to benefit those in the middle and the bottom disproportionately. So,
right.
Yeah, and the other way is through direct increases in government spending. And so just one example would be, say, a large-scale infrastructure investment program that would directly inject new demand spending into the economy, hire millions of people, and lead to job creation both directly through employing people and boosting demand for everything from steel and concrete to machinery and so forth, and then through the indirect jobs channel. As those people get higher incomes and jobs, they turn around and spend more, and so there's a multiplier effect.
Right. Great. Now, I was reading the Wikipedia article on modern monetary theory, and Paul Krugman claimed that the proponents of MMT do not have an adequate way of controlling inflation. Your response?
Well, no one controls inflation. No theory. There is no quote way of controlling inflation. So first, you have to step back and say, what is inflation? Inflation is a generalized increase in prices. Think of it as a broad, across-the-board increase in the prices of a whole range of things. And the way that economists measure inflation is mostly through price indices like the Consumer Price Index. So we hear people talk about the CPI, you know, on TV, read articles about consumer price indices, CPI. So if you think, what drives inflation higher? You have to look at, well, what are the components of CPI? How do we actually measure inflation? And it turns out that some of the main drivers of inflation are things like housing and healthcare and energy. And so if you think, you know, how are you going to control the inflation rate? Well, how are you going to control the rate of increase in the price of housing or energy or healthcare, right? And so there is no single policy tool that anyone can design that's going to, quote, control the rate of inflation. But if you think that inflation is mostly the result of, as Milton Friedman, the famous Chicago School economist, decades ago put it, if you think inflation is mostly the result of too much money chasing too few goods, then what you're saying is, you get an inflation problem when people are trying to spend more than the economy can produce at that time. There's too much demand. And so the MMT answer to that problem is, well, you obviously have to do something to reduce demand, because in the short run, it's a bit more difficult to increase supply to meet higher demand, or at least it often is. So if you think you have an inflation problem because people are trying to spend too much, what would you do? Well, one option would be to increase taxes, because that would lower people's incomes, and therefore you would expect them to spend less because they have lower income. And the other option is to reduce government spending. So if the problem is too much spending and too few goods, the solution must be, at least in the short run, reduce the amount of spending and then take measures to allow supply to increase over time. So MMT has a perfectly reasonable response to the problem of inflation. That is, you raise taxes or you cut spending or you do a combination of the two.
Right. Of course, that seems like it's pretty difficult to do if you got to rely on Congress to come to consensus on that.
Yeah, but that's true, but that can't be Paul Krugman's argument against MMT, because everything is difficult to do if you have to rely on Congress. In the textbook world, and he knows this because he is the author of different textbooks, in the textbook world, it's simple. You just have a model, and you print it down on a piece of paper, and you got a couple of curves, supply and demand curves, or IS and LM curves, or however you want to label them. And you just shift the curve. You say, well, I want to increase output and employment, so I'm going to shift this curve. Well, everybody knows it's easy to draw a new line. We can all shift curves. But in the real world, it takes policy decisions. It takes sometimes literally an act of Congress to accomplish those things. So that's not a problem that's unique to MMT, and he knows that.
I found your blog where you talked about Jimmy Carter does not get credit for contributing to the fall of inflation in the early Reagan years from deregulation of natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point. The point is, when I say it's difficult to control inflation and nobody has a tool to do that, the one type of inflation is the kind I described already, which is there's too much demand in the economy. This has not been our problem. The U.S. has not experienced any kind of significant inflation as a result of, we call it, economists use the phrase demand pull, too much demand in the economy and not enough ability to meet that demand with increasing supply. And so you drive up prices. That's not been our problem. The most significant inflation that we experienced in recent memory, for those of us old enough to remember it, was the inflation of the 1970s. And that was a very different kind of inflation. That was not the excessive demand causing prices to increase. That was due to shocks on the supply side, largely. And so there we're talking about OPEC and cartels with pricing power and the ability to raise the price of oil. And then that getting passed through into the costs of transportation and final goods and all that sort of stuff. So anyway, a job guarantee is probably the most effective way to anchor the currency to promote some stability in the price level. I mean, we're not claiming that a job guarantee will give you price stability, that inflation will be zero or constant or stable,
right,
or anything like that, right? But that there are benefits to having the wage anchored through a federal job guarantee program that carry over into the overall price level in the economy.
Uh-huh.
So, but again, inflation can be caused, you can have inflation because, Saudi Arabia says we're going to restrict supply and we're going to allow the price of oil to increase. And because they've been the swing producer, they can do that. And oil prices go up. And if they want them at $80 a barrel, they'll be $80 a barrel. They want them back at 100, they'll go back to 100. And with oil at 100 or 120, or if they want 104, you know what I mean? Now, because of innovations, if you want to call them that, in hydraulic fracking and so forth, beyond some point, it becomes profitable for us to, develop alternative sources of energy. And then we can counter some of that sort of, the effects of those price increases. But there are things that can happen on the supply side that can drive inflation higher that may be very difficult to respond in terms of economic policy. What do you do if you have an oil price shock? How do you respond to that? How do you reduce overall inflation? Versus if it happens on the demand side, which I already explained, our response to that is that if the problem is people are trying to spend too much into an economy that isn't capable of matching that higher demand with increased supply, and so it's causing prices to rise, then in the short run, the solution is, well, you got to eliminate some of that demand. So you either have the federal government spend less on its own, or you get everybody else in the economy, to spend less, mostly consumers, because they do 70% of all the spending. So you raise taxes so that they have less income so that they spend less.
Great. Now, just another question. I heard, I think I've already said I attended your post-Keynesian conference in September. One of the things I've heard is that you and the people in your department have consulted periodically with local politicians. What's your message to, what has been your message to, mayors and so forth?
Well, I don't know what others have done. I know that people like Peter Eaton and maybe Linwood Tahid, Eric Olson, they may be interacting with Mayor James and maybe members of the city council and so forth. I personally have not. I interact with members of the business community, and I interact more at the federal level than at the state or local level. But, you know, there is a difference, obviously. The type of economic advice that you can give at the federal government level is not subject to the same sort of constraints as it is when you're talking to mayor of a city or even the governor of a state. Federal government can do things that state governors and mayors can't do, and that's mostly because the federal government is the issuer of its own currency, and
right.
governors and mayors are not. They're just users of the currency, and so they're dependent upon tax revenue in a way that the federal government is not. And so decision-making and policy-making, it just is subject to fundamentally different constraints.
Regarding the Kansas Open Meetings Act, you will hear comments from Lawrence physician Alan Coles, recorded on December 28th. A couple of years ago, Dr. Coles learned privately of a $750,000 lawsuit against governing bodies in Douglas County. It was big enough, he thought, that some discussion of it should appear in the published minutes of the relevant governing bodies. When he could not find it there, he suspected violations of the Kansas Open Meetings Act. This encouraged him to review roughly 10,000 pages of minutes of public meetings of the 10 most populous counties and cities in Kansas. He found documentation of questionable secrecy in all but one jurisdiction. He then collaborated with his local League of Women Voters and his state senator, Marcy Francisco, to introduce legislation into the Kansas State Senate to remove ambiguities in the Kansas Open Meetings Act to support greater transparency in government. This legislation died in 2016, but will likely be reintroduced in 2017.
So I'm speaking with Alan Coles, who practices medicine in Lawrence, Kansas, and volunteers with the League of Women Voters there. In the latter capacity, Dr. Coles conducted a fairly extensive research project into the level of compliance with the Kansas Open Meetings Act. Dr. Coles, please summarize for our listeners how you got interested in this, and what did you find?
I got interested in it because I witnessed the Douglas County Health Board, the Lawrence City Commission, and the Douglas County Commission in 2012 and 2013 successfully covering up a $750,000 lawsuit. Now, I knew about the lawsuit because I knew the people involved, but most of the citizens of the city of Lawrence and Douglas County had no idea that there was any $750,000 lawsuit that was had been filed against the health board, the city, and the county. And I thought, well, we've got an Open Meetings Act, don't we? How does this happen if we got an Open Meetings Act that they can, these governmental bodies can discuss a $750,000 lawsuit for a year and a half, and nobody knows about it? And so I looked into the Kansas Open Meetings Act, and I found that the wording is sufficiently confusing with sufficient undefined terms so that it allows this sort of thing. And from there, I studied the closings of meetings by the 10 largest county governmental bodies and the 10 largest city governmental bodies, and I found that 95% of these at some time or other close meetings without giving the public any meaningful, and that's a key word, meaningful information about what they're going to discuss. So the public is left ignorant of things that they ought to know about.
And you published a report on this, right?
Yes, the report is available at kansasopenmeetings.org, Kansas Open Meetings is basically, as a web address, is one word, that's .org.
What is your involvement with the League of Women Voters?
Well, I began to study this on my own and then went to the League of Women Voters because I think the League is very concerned about open government in a positive way, of course. And I went to the League for support, and we have been working together, basically.
Right. Okay, so that's very interesting. Thank you. And by the way, if you search for Radioactive Magazine, the listeners can search for Radioactive Magazine at KTFI.org. I will post a link there to the Kansas Open Meetings .org. So another question. Has this contributed to any actual legislative work?
Yes, it has. About a year ago, Senator Marcy Francisco and I wrote a bill basically amending the Kansas Open Meetings Act to clarify the terms and requirements. And along with one of the revisers of statutes, we came up with a bill which Senator Francisco submitted, and it got referred to the Committee on the Judiciary, and we had hearings, and this brought forth the people who had concerns about the language of the proposed amendment. And after that, we had a meeting, and in 45 minutes, we got together and we agreed on the wording. And then Senator Francisco submitted that again as Senate Bill 487. Now, Senate Bill 487 died in committee when the last legislative term closed. And Senator Francisco intends to reintroduce the same amendment again in the coming legislative session.
So what would, if we have some of our, roughly half of our listeners, I think, are in Kansas, what can our Kansas citizens do to improve compliance with the Kansas Open Meetings Act?
Well, the first thing I think citizens can do is to contact their legislators. I recommend they go to KansasOpenMeetings.org, where they can get a two-page summary of the issue and just take a couple of minutes to study that. And contact their legislators, let them know that they feel that open government is important and that the amendment to the Kansas Open Meetings Act needs to be passed in this coming session. The other thing they can do is go to meetings, that is, governmental meetings, city commission meetings, county commission meetings, and such, and just observe if they want to join a more formal organization to, or at least get together with an organization which is trying to consistently and methodically cover governmental meetings, they can contact the League of Women Voters about the Observer Corps. That's a way to do that. And incidentally, if they have questions, if people have questions about open meetings practices, they're welcome to contact me through the website, KansasOpenMeetings.org.
Okay. Great. By the way, the Observer Corps are, I'm told, a function of the standard function of the League of Women Voters. Is that your understanding?
That is correct. I think people will find that the Observer Corps welcomes anyone who wants to help. You don't have to be a formal member of the League to become a member of the Observer Corps.
Right. Search on the web for your local league in Lawrence. There's a Lawrence Douglas County branch of the league. There's a Johnson County branch of the league. I don't know about other branches in Kansas.
There's a state league which can direct people to other branches.
Sure. Now, there was also a post on the Daily Kos recently where that was basically inviting people to attend public meetings and just blog about what they saw on the Daily Kos, and they said, and the author said that could be the only written record, independent record of those meetings. So it's important and useful to have that. And just a plug for KKFI Radio, we're trying to work toward getting more local news. And if we can find a way to connect with people in the Observer Corps, I'll be meeting with the Observer Corps in January, I think, of the Johnson County League, and talk about how we can all do this and how we can generate newscasts around that.
Sounds good.
So I guess you've answered my next question, which was, why did you think this was important enough to justify the substantial amount of time you put into it?
Well, government without citizen participation doesn't work. At least it doesn't work nearly as well as it does with citizen participation.
Both Kansas and Missouri will have local elections in 2017. People will be selected to fill posts in municipal, school, and water boards. Kansas will have a primary on August 1st and a general on November 7th. For details, check the website of your county election office, e.g. jocoelection.org for Johnson County. Missouri is more complicated. They have elections tentatively scheduled for February 7th, March 7th, April 4th, August 8th, and November 8th, depending upon where you live. The optional February, August, and November elections are for bond issues and other initiatives. March 7 is for charter cities and counties. The Jackson County Election Board is currently planning for elections on only one of those dates, namely April 4th. Officials for many but not all local governmental bodies in Jackson County will have elections on that date. In particular, Lee's Summit would not normally have an election on that date because their city council elections are on even-numbered years. However, in 2017, they may have a recall election to remove City Councilman Chris Moreno. A recall petition with the requisite signatures has been filed. The Jackson County Election Board will announce on January 24 whether they have certified enough of those signatures to require the recall. If you live in Missouri, check your county election board website 5 weeks before the above dates.